Center for Venus.
I'm early.
Hello.
Hello, Donna. Am I too early? Shall I go again?
No, no, please stay.
Okay.
Don't go, don't go.
Okay.
Please, please.
Good. Good evening all, yes, everybody. Hello, Andre. Michael. That's not Michael, is it?
Good evening.
Barb's there. Laura's there. Donna.
Everybody. Hello, Robina.
Hello, Robina.
Hello, Robina.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Morning.
Hello, everybody. Morning. Who's in the morning? An Australian there.
Who am I?
Where are you?
I'm politically incorrect. I have to lie down, so I've got myself covered.
There you go, Gemma. She's in New South Wales. Good.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning.
Well done. I'm glad it's a civilized hour for you, darling. Okay. So here we do our little motivation. Set ourselves in the right direction. The first two lines are for those of us who kind of figure we're Buddhists already, so it's reminding us of our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings. So then the second lines are just stating our purpose. We'd say that. What's our purpose? Why are we here together? To listen to Buddha's amazing views about the universe with a very objective, open mind to see that if there's anything there that we can take as tools that we can use in our life to help us develop our unbelievable potential so we can be of benefit to others all the way to Buddhahood. That's the plan, okay? Sangye Chadam Soke Chognam La Jan Shobadu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Chanyen Gipa Sonam Ki Drola Penche Sangye Drupa Shog Sangye Chadam Soke Chognam La Jan Shobadu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Chanyen Gipa Sonam Ki Drola Penche Sangye Drupa Shog Sangye Chadam Soke Chognam La Jan Shobadu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi chanyan gipa sonam ki drola penche sangye drubha sho. All right. Well, everything we've talked about so far, we've touched upon the junior school and high school, we've touched upon the wisdom wing, we've touched upon the Theravadin level of teachings, we've touched upon the first and second scopes of the Lam Rim. They are all synonymous, okay? It's these first stages of practice. It's like all the nuts and bolts of Buddha's view of the universe, which we need to learn well so we can internalize it. And that's the fundamental basis of our practice. Abiding by the laws of karma. Why? Because every millisecond of what we think and do and say programs us, turns us into the person we become in the future. We are our own creator. It's a good way to put it, you know. So given that we don't want suffering and do want happiness, the first level of practice, as Lama Zopa says, immediate, urgent, entry level, junior school, right now, this second, stop harming sentient beings because they sow seeds in our mind that will produce future suffering. And guess what, folks? We don't want suffering. There's no discussion of compassion yet. It's compassion for ourselves. So then we start, you know, harness our energy and then we start to purify our karma. So we're really pulling out the weeds like crazy and making space in our mind and controlled by controlling our body and speech. So now we've got the luxury to go to the next level of practice, which is to start to unpack and unravel all the crazy parts of our mind and do this fundamental job of being a Buddhist, of distinguishing between the neuroses and the virtues. That's the bottom line from here to Buddhahood. And now we would study Buddhist psychology. We'd understand what a delusion is. We'd understand what a virtue is. We'd understand these different components in our mind. This is when we start to really become a Buddhist. You know, so we can learn to unpack and unravel what on earth is going on in this crazy consciousness of ours, you know. Now the thing is, this is preparing us for the next level, which is the Bodhisattva path, but there's two components there. There's, you know, if we look at the three principal aspects of the path, this framing, this packaging of the teachings that Tsongkhapa gives us, we've now just covered the renunciation component with junior school and high school. So the next one is bodhicitta. Well, we're going to bypass that, but it's also crucial. But we're now going to go to the final stages of the Bodhisattva path, which is the six perfections of the Bodhisattva, and the first four of those are where you perfect the compassion wing. But the last two are where we now look into the perfecting the wisdom wing. So that's concentration meditation, and which is called calm abiding. We have to accomplish that, and on the basis of which we can then accomplish the final one, which is the wisdom that gets insight into finally how everything does exist, which points us really to the fundamental point that Buddha's making across the board, which is that these deluded states of mind, these neurotic states of mind, these misconceptions, these afflictions, all these different words that we know, you know, and there are many synonyms for them, the part of us that is painful, that causes us suffering and causes us to harm others, and this is talking about every person in the universe, every being in the universe, this stuff. This is Buddha's entire brilliant point. As I mentioned on the first day, the work of being a Buddhist is implied by the word Buddha itself. The end result of this entire programming. The end result of this entire path to enlightenment. The end result, Buddha. Buddha, or Sangye, the Tibetan equivalent, tells us, implies that the utter eradication from our minds of all neuroses, all ego-based delusions. And the second syllable implies the development to perfection of all the virtues, all the good, all the valid states of mind. So, of course, this way of talking, as we know very well, is not the way we frame the mind in our culture. That's why we might hear all these simple words like anger and attachment and jealousy and ignorance, but Buddha's got his own incredibly specific way of presenting all of this. And unless we understand how he sees all this, and this is the high school work, we will not understand what being a Buddhist means. We will not understand what a Buddha means. We will not understand the practice. We will not know what to do. Very simple. Now, the point is this, though. There's one way of seeing. The first level of practice, abide by the laws of karma, is basically Buddha's presentation of ethics, you know. But the interesting point here is, in order to prepare us for the wisdom teachings right at the end of the path, of the six perfections, you can say that a powerful learning from karma is, given that it's the law of cause and effect, and given when we get to emptiness, which we're going to talk about tonight, the king of logics, as Lama Yeshe says, is dependent arising to prove emptiness, and given that karma, the law of cause and effect, is an example of the first level of dependent arising, which is that everything exists in dependence upon causes. So one of the most powerful implications, or if you like, experiential implications, and if we're doing it properly, experiences, period, of applying the law of karma, is that it loosens the grip of ego grasping. It's the beginning of thinking about dependent arising. Because right now, with the usual way we think of ourself, we really believe I'm this piece of concrete lump set in stone, plonked onto this planet by somebody else, and they didn't bother to consult me. And we live our lives in panic and fear, having good luck and bad luck, not knowing what the hell is going on or why. And we really believe we're innocent victims. We really believe we didn't ask to get born, and we really believe it's not our fault. They are the experiential implications of a concrete, set in stone, uncaused, permanent me. So by thinking about cause and effect, it loosens the grip of that. And we start to heal this bizarre disconnect between me and reality. And we start to realize that everything, as Lama Zopa says, is our karmic appearance. Everything is created by me, and I am in charge. And this is profound level of practice. That's junior school, people. So it's already preparing us to understand emptiness. Now we really get to the nitty-gritty. In high school, we get to the mind, and this is where we learn to distinguish between the neuroses and the virtues. And this is, as I said, Buddha's unique approach. But the point here is this. When we learn about these neurotic states of mind, you know, the 84,000 that Buddha would lay out, this big map of the mind. I mean, everybody I ask never knows where the big map is, but it has to be there somewhere, because Buddha did say he presents there are 84,000 afflictions, and then he says he's got a plan of 84,000 antidotes. But anyway, nevertheless, as we all know, when we study the mind, and this is fundamental from day one again, we hear about how they all subsume to the three. Three, ignorance, attachment, anger. These simple words. But when we begin to understand the character of these neurotic states of mind, and this is, again, unique to the Buddhist approach. It's unique to the Buddhist approach, just to the mind. And it's a revelation. And when we understand this point I'm about to say, this is when we can begin to understand what being a Buddhist means. This is when we can begin to understand how we can get rid of delusions and grow the virtues. This is when we learn this. But unless we study the Buddhist model of the mind, unless we not just do mindfulness, that's fine, but it's not going to help you know the mind. You've got to study the components of it. You've got to study the nuts and bolts of what is the mind. How does it function? This is fundamental. So we know, we are looking here into the mental consciousness. We discussed this, I think, 2 days ago. We've got sensory consciousness and mental consciousness. So when you study the mind, we study Lohrig, and I'm sure in Rowley there, Geshe-la's taught it, or somebody's taught it, and I hope you do, and you should do it more often, Donna. Have you studied Lohrig? You have. Well, it's you've got to study it, and then you've got to practice it. If you're studying it's not enough, just practice it then. Put meat on the bones, you know. So what you learn is, first of all, you study the epistemological model of the mind, which is the way the mind, you know, the way the mind functions. And so the mind functions with a sensory consciousness, and then we have mental consciousness. And it's unbelievably necessary to distinguish these. Absolutely vital. We mix them completely now because we have such kind of attachment to our bodily experiences. We think everything's the body. We make the body the boss, as Lamiesi says. We completely misunderstand the way the mind works. So when we understand that sensory consciousness, you know, with respect to animals, there's a bunch of dumb animals. The sensory consciousnesses, the ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue, taste, tactile, they're profoundly limited in their capacity for cognition. They're profoundly limited, you know. But we give them so much more power than they have because we're so addicted to our physical experiences. Then we have the mental consciousness. That's where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa puts it. That's what we have to learn to unpack and unravel and deconstruct and then reconstruct into the mind of a Buddha. It's the mental consciousness. So what's that? So let's go now to the psychological model. But even first, before we go there, the epistemological model, there's two ways that our mental consciousness functions. This is massively important to understand. Not evident to us at all, but crucial. So the mental consciousness, generally mind functions in two ways. There's different ways of presenting, but the way here is sensory and mental. So mental functions in two ways. One is called perception and one is called conception. That's it. Now this is not the way we think, the way we use the word perception. That's perfectly fine. Everybody's allowed to define the words they like. But here is a very specific definition. Perception here is in the mental consciousness is referring to a much subtler level of cognition that we will not access until we have perfected concentration meditation. So that means we live at the other level. That means we live at the level of concepts. Now, that's surprising for us. In our world, when we say conceptual, we point up here, don't we? But if we say emotional, we'll point down here at the heart. Now, for the Buddha, the level we function at from the second we wake up until the second we go to sleep is only conceptual. And it includes all the clever thoughts and it includes all the emotions. This is the shock to us. So we need to understand this. In other words, what Buddha's saying is this, and we can see this in our life. I've been pointing this out quite a lot. Our trouble is we only notice. Okay, now we go to the psychological model of the mind. And now here exclusively, we're going to talk about mental consciousness and how it functions and how the contents of our mental consciousness. This is the work we have to do. This is where the workshop is. This is what we have to become familiar with. Why? As I've been saying, Buddha classifies all the contents of this crazy mental consciousness of ours, the millions of thoughts and feelings and emotions and unconscious and subconscious, instinct, intuition, you name it, the lot. We have to unpack and unravel that. And that's Buddha's skill. That's his brilliance. That's his expertise. And we live at the level of conceptual. We don't touch the subtler level. So perception in this framework, in this context, is literally non-conceptual. So we know very well in our mind we don't have such a thought. Everything comes down to be conceptual. So we only when we've got a single point of concentration that we begin to go beyond the conceptual and beyond the sensory. So when you've got calm abiding, you will have, you know, you will have non-conceptual kind of cognitions. And they're very, it's like the microscope of your mind, where it's beyond conceptual and beyond sensory. We don't posit such a level of mind as existing in our culture. That's it. Because that level of cognition doesn't depend upon a brain. It's much subtler. This is the fundamental point to understand when Buddha talks about the mind. He's got his own specific approach. And, of course, it came from these genius Indians before him. As His Holiness said, you know, these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago. were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. These genius Indians did all this work, and then Buddha died, went as far as he could go there, and then he diverged in his own direction, particularly in relation to his own experiential findings about the nature of self, which we're going to talk about tonight. But we've been leading up to this. So, the point is this. All our intellectual thoughts about maths and science would seem so rational, don't they? Then all our emotions, for us this is another universe, our emotions, our feelings. And this is the one we're going to be, this is the one we're preoccupied with. Buddha's expertise is in the theories about cooking and mathematics. I'm sure he was good at it, but it's not his deal. His deal is to sort out the mess of these emotions. And the point is this, very simple. They are all rooted in being conceptual stories. Everything we experience, love, anger, kindness, generosity, they're all conceptual stories informing our body and therefore causing feelings. And our trouble is, because we're so obsessed with our body, with our bodily experiences, and that's reinforced with our science and everything, we don't notice what is going on in our mind until it hits the mouth. And you don't know you're angry until the words are vomiting out your mouth and your heart is shaking, you're shouting and yelling and spit is coming out of your mouth and tears coming out of your eyes. Oh, I must be angry. Little bit late. You don't know you're depressed, and which is your mind, until you're inert in bed. Because this is what we've been discussing, and this is our worst suffering and our biggest misconception in our culture. Because we don't have techniques that enable us to see what is going on in our mind before it becomes emotional. That's our major problem. That's our major problem, I tell you. And when we can begin to see what Buddha's giving us and the ability that he's giving us, it's a miracle. It's like a revelation, I can't tell you. But we have to learn to see what's happening in our mind before it becomes physical. That's the only time we notice it. As Lama Zopa says, the vast majority of all humans on this planet have absolutely no idea that what is going on in their mind, in their thoughts, raging all day. There's no idea that any of that plays any role at all in our lives. We're so demented, you know. So here in high school, in the middle scope, we get to the root of the problem. We now have to unpack the mind and learn it. Now, how does that help us realize emptiness? We're really getting close to home now. That is when we realize that this mental consciousness, let's look into the three categories, the way Buddha classifies all these thousands of thoughts and feelings and emotions into three categories. One is neurotic, deluded, ridiculous. They all call them afflictions, remember? The afflictions, you know, that term in Sanskrit, klesha, affliction, an illness, a mental illness, literal translation, I tell you. Then you've got the valid, reasonable states of mind. So the first lot, you've got attachment and anger and jealousy and depression and low self-esteem and aggression. You name it. We know them intimately. And there's 84,000 of these. Don't be surprised. Be surprised. The second lot, they're the good ones, the virtuous ones, the valid ones, the reasonable ones. They're called love, kindness, generosity. We heard these words a million times. We are intimately familiar with all these states of mind. We put them in a big soup, don't we? And we give them equal status. And we go, oh, yeah, we've all got a bit of those, a bit of this, a bit of that, and you're a normal person. And that's why, you know, just recently I remember, and this is, we're so used, if you're a Buddhist, you study this so often that you're used to it, but you forget how shocking this sounds to new ears. One woman at a class, she was just absolutely speechless. She said, because hearing that Buddha says the neurotic ones can be got rid of. But she said, you'd be the weirdest person in the world. And that's reasonable to understand that, because our view of a person has all of these. A normal person has fear. A normal person gets angry. A normal person has jealousy. That's, and all of our psychology factors these things in. Our whole models of normal psychological behavior factor these things in. So all of our models support the existence of these states of mind. So to hear that you can get rid of them, that's a demented thing to do. Why would you want to? We can't even conceive of a person who didn't have those unhappy states of mind. So it's hard to hear Buddha's view because of this. It's so radical what he's saying, I tell you. It's very fascinating. Now the point is this. Why is this leading us to understand emptiness, preparing us? because the neurotic states of mind, the afflictions, being conceptual stories, are misconceptions. That's it. They're not valid because they're not in sync with reality. It's very simple. Anger, for example, is a conceptual story. And we said yesterday, what does anger say? How it rises up, doesn't it? How dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. How dare that happen to me? So that's coming from a powerful assumption in the mind because it's linked completely to the previous state of mind, which is attachment. It's the expression of thwarted attachment. And what's the concept that attachment is saying? Attachment is this default junkie in this that assumes every second I deserve only the good things. So what is that rooted in? The deepest misconception, because there's a hierarchical relationship between these three, this summary of the 84,000. The anger is this, how dare that happen to me, which is an assumption rooted on the assumption, the attachment that I only deserve good things. And that itself is the expression, the voice of the root delusion that posits a separate, definite, solid, permanent, concrete me in the first place. So they are liars. They are misconceptions. The part that's shocking here is when you see a person who's shouting and yelling and spit coming out of the mouth and tears coming out of the eyes, and you see that they're angry, but to hear that that anger is a concept sounds hilarious to us. Like, what do you mean it's a concept? Look, and they're emotional. That's only your body. That's only your body. Your body's not angry. Don't be silly. Anger's the mind. And this is the point, because the anger in the mind is such a habit, because you practiced anger to perfection, as a little girl, my mother did not have to teach me anger. I had it down. I got born with it. So this is what we mean. You see, this is fascinating. What we mean by instinct is that something happens so automatically, it's beyond thought. Well, Buddha says we get programmed. We come into this life at the time of conception, programmed with 99% of what we do as at a level of instinct. Because we practice them for countless lives. Anything that you do often enough is a thing that you know how to do automatically. Look at a person who's perfected music on the piano. They just have to sit there. You watch Robbie play the piano. His little fingers whiz up and down the piano while he's having a gossip with you. Because he's trained himself. With what? Listen to this. He's trained his mind with the concepts of musical theory, according to Bach. He's got it so down and his hands are so familiar with playing all those notes that it's literally now instinct because he's practiced it before. It's exactly the same with our emotions. The little boy, the son of a friend of mine, who when he's 3 years old is crying with compassion for the lice that his mummy was taking out of his head. Spontaneously crying with compassion. His mother hadn't taught him this. Mummy, mummy, leave them alone. It's their home. Don't hurt them. No one had taught him that. That was emotion, feeling. There was tears. But that's based in what? It was rooted in his mind with instinctive compassion, compassionate thoughts. He had empathy for the lice. Where did that come from? He must have practiced it. So now it's automatic and it's instinctive and it's emotional. So the body is just the gross expression of what's in our mind. Now, when we understand the Vajrayana model, this really helps us understand how come. This is a really fascinating explanation. It's the Vajrayana model, which is the same model that the Tibetan medical system is based on. So they say that we've got gross consciousness, which is this bag of bones, connected to this bag of bones, and a gross body, this bag of bones, and all our sensory consciousnesses. Then we have subtle consciousness. We don't posit it in our culture. That's your mental states and much more subtle levels of your mental states. And we've got a subtle physical energy. And that's 72,000 subtle channels coursing through the body through which are coursing from head to toe these thousands of different wind energies or prana. It's all very scientific. The Tibetans studied for 15 years this model, the same as the Chinese one, similar. And along with those states of mind, inextricably linked to them, this is the fundamental point in the Vajrayana, along with those wind energies, inside those channels, from head to toe, are all our different states of mind. Now, clearly this is not how we talk in our culture. We talk about them in the brain, right? It's a very different model. And this is the point. As Lama Zopa said, there are detailed descriptions in the Kala Chakra Tantra, you know, of the intimate relationship between internal and external energy. And this helps us explain karma. So the internal is your mind. Your external is the physical. So in these channels, this our mind is coursing through these channels connected to their own wind energies. When your Tibetan doctor can feel your pulses, she can feel exactly which winds are in balance, and she knows it's related to your anger or your attachment or your jealousy. They're so sophisticated. So that there's a relationship. So as Lama Zopa says, when you're just simply even being angry in your mind, forget about your speech, that pollutes. First of all, it karmically develops the habit to keep being angry. You're like Robbie practicing music. You're practicing anger. You keep getting better at it. It gets more instinctive. And what it does simultaneously is pollute your wind energies. Well, that karmically causes you to get future sickness. You cause it. That's just your mind. It's so intricate, this whole system, explaining it. So we can see there's a relation between mind and body. When you're shouting, yelling, angry, you know, your body is shaking. There's a storm inside there because your winds have gone berserk. But emotions are simply the habit of having practiced love, compassion, jealousy, anger, whatever it might be, so often that it's automatic, it's instinctive, it's second nature, you've got it down, baby, and it affects your body, obviously, because your body and your mind are interconnected. So all of those, that anger, it is emotional. Yes, your body's shaking, but that's only the body. That's not your mind. Your mind is the anger, and it's a conceptual story. Look at what's coming out of that person's mouth. How dare you do that to me? You're the cause of all my suffering. I want to kill you. I hate you. Look at it. It's the mind, and it's concepts, except that they're very loud concepts, that's all. Equally, I always use this example. If you can record a person raging and shouting and yelling and then transcribe their words, you'd recognize it's merely concepts on a piece of paper. The words are coming out their mouth. You can tell immediately it's anger. But you might be a person who doesn't shout, but you've got a very angry mind. If you kindly write down your angry thoughts for us, you're going to have two bits of paper, aren't you? One of them, you can't hear any shouting. You've got two bits of paper with a bunch of words on them. And anybody with half a brain, when they read those words, can go, oh, wow, these people are angry. It's angry thoughts. There's no shouting. And even the person who doesn't shout, their thoughts might even be more violent than the shouting person. So anger is in the mind, and it's a series. So it's emotional. Now let's look at the crucial piece. What do you mean it's a misconception? This is the part that takes us time to see. And when we can get this, we are Buddhists, I tell you. And it's hard. What does Buddha mean? Anger is a misconception. What does he mean? Attachment's a misconception. The emotional part we can see. That's easy. One of the synonyms is disturbing emotions. Pretty clear it's disturbing. Why is jealousy a misconception? And, of course, the one we're getting to, ego grasping, the root delusion. Now we're going to get to emptiness, and that's the root misconception. But we don't have to wait till we get to the sixth perfection to learn about misconceptions. You learn that in high school. When we realize this, this leads us and helps us understand how ego grasping is the root misconception and how we deconstruct that and remove it from our mind, thus getting out of samsara. So, if we can see how attachment and anger are misconceptions, then it is easy to see how ignorance is a misconception. It's just a subtle one, that's all. That's all it is. But it's got exactly the same character. And this is the key point in Buddhist psychology. This is the point. This is brilliant, unique approach, you know. Well, you know, one conventional way, which we're going to talk about, one way of talking about reality. The key point the Buddha's making all the way across the board from here to Buddhahood is that, guess what, folks? Your delusions in your mind, your misconceptions, they are causing you to not be in touch with reality, which then causes you to suffer, which then causes you to harm others, which then causes you to have future suffering life, and that's how we keep going. So we have to cut and get to the root, you know? So, because we're living in la-la land, this is just what he's saying. That's why the word in English is so brilliant, delusion. It's a brilliant word, I tell you. Just talking to, you know, I've got French people tonight. Oh, tonight, no, it's tomorrow night, Thursday. But I just recently had had Spaniards. No, was it Italians? Who was I recently? I forget. I lose my memory. Spanish. Italian. Where was I recently? I can't remember. But anyway, Italian. I think, no, Spanish was Mexican. That's right. I was in Mexico last week. I mean, in my room, in my house here, but I was in Mexico on Zoom, okay? And in Spanish, there is a word delusion, but it's like very arcane. Nobody uses it, so it's a silly word. But it's a brilliant word in English. It tells us exactly, it's bullseye for describing how Buddha says, what the way Buddha says these delusions function. Because delusion, you know, if you're accused of being delusional, you'll be very offended. They're telling you that you're not in touch with reality. And we know that's a serious mental illness. Well, guess what? Buddha says you're all mentally ill, baby. As long as you have any attachment, any anger, any jealousy, any of this 84,000 nonsense, you are delusional. And I'm not being sarcastic here. But it takes a while to see this. Because you know why? Because every thought that comes into our mind, this is the worst part of samsara. We believe it's true. That's our problem. You know, if the Donna's angry with me, if she's mean to me, she didn't come to on our date, she didn't turn up for dinner, or she wrote me a mean email. You know, when I'm angry and I am hurt, the hurt is real. Don't dismiss it, because the habit is very strong. And how dare Donna do this to me? It's not fair. How dare she? She's awful. I think of her. I don't like the look of her. I get upset. Everything I hear about her, she's awful. I've painted a picture of awful Donna. We know this, and I believe my picture. It's so simple. It's so profound. It's so obvious. I believe my picture because I'm seeing Donna through the lenses of my anger. Now, when my Donna was my friend, I saw her through the lenses of my attachment, and she looked delicious. She looked delicious, didn't she? We all know this, but we forget. We forget the past story. We just believe whatever we see now. This is, the Buddha says, this is the main cause of us being paralyzed in samsara. And that's why Lama Zopa said we've got to stop believing in our karmic appearances. So, so, so hard. So basically these emotional states of mind, the really powerful emotional ones, like ego grasping, attachment, anger, the others, they have this massive emotional component which touches, affects the body, and they are rooted in literally being misconceptions. Wrong conceptual stories that aren't a valid assessment of reality. So this is the point now. Well, there's Donna. Forget Mr. Trump. Let's talk about Donna. I mean, our friends. There's Donna, my friend. Just a simple example. Your friend, your sister. Forget Mr. Trump. Doesn't matter. When a person's hurt you, and she might have hurt me, she might have been mean. We all hurt each other, don't we? She might have hurt me. She got upset one day, so she said some mean words. So this is the point. Because we learned this in high school, because I'm so, my hunger, my attachment, this terrible hunger, emotional hunger, to only get nice words. We're desperate for nice words. We have to hear nice words. We can't bear the pain of hearing sounds, ugly sounds with my name in them. So we're frantic. The attachment is a junkie that only wants to hear praising words, pleasing words, nice words. Join the universe. We're all like it. It's okay. So the millisecond I hear unkind words, my attachment is offended, isn't it? It's completely offended. And then aversion, a hurt, and the pain of anger. How dare she do that to me? How dare she say that to me? We know that's how we respond. The pain is very real. No one's dismissing the pain. That's real. That's not a lie. That's not a misconception. That pain is real because of the habit. So what's not real? Well, this is hard to hear. So, you know, so the fact is we can prove Donna did say those bad words. Everybody saw it. We prove it. We tick the box. That's proof. That's fact. Buddha's not even arguing with that. He's not saying she didn't say those unkind words. He's not even saying that's reality. She did say them. So where's the unreality part? What is anger exaggerating? You see, so okay, the delusions, their key way, and that's including ego grasping, which we get it to, but emptiness. The key way they are misconceptions, this is the function of them, the key way that they are misconceptions is that they exaggerate, they embellish. So what is my anger exaggerating in this scenario when Donna said mean words to me? I'm exaggerating the ugliness, the badness, because anger sees bad. Anger exaggerates that badness. That's it. It's so simple. Now, we can prove that. You can, you know, some people we can see don't have much anger. So when a person is mean to them, they kind of laugh it off. That doesn't worry them. That's proof right there that my anger, who practically when I want to practically, you know, kill Donna and never forgive her for the next 74 years, it's really evidence that that, you know, let's say me, we know people like this, and they will never forgive Donna again. They'll never forget that word she said to them when they were 14, you know. You can, everybody knows that person's exaggerating. They're kind of making a mountain out of a molehill, like our mother tells us. That's the point that Buddha's making. One tiny thing, if you've got masses of anger or whatever the delusion is, when even a small thing happens, you make it massively big. That's the way anger is not in touch with reality. And then what it does, because I'm so offended and I'm so hurt and I'm so upset and the upset is real, that even in my mind, the picture I have of Donna is of a horrible person. We know this. But how come yesterday she looked gorgeous to me? We don't question this obvious contradiction. I mean, she just did one action. She just did one action, some mean words. And the whole of Donna now looks terrible. And we can see in this life, some people have such hurt, such anger, such upset, so fragile, so much attachment, that the tiniest thing, they can go mad because of it. We can see this. This is what Buddha's telling us. Delusions our emotional afflictions exaggerate a certain characteristic of the object. It's exactly the same with attachment. If I'm in love with Andre, if I'm completely obsessed, and we can see attachment, you can lose your brain. You can be so out of control, thinking day and night, 24 hours a day about that divine person, writing an entire novel for the rest of your life. Imagining being with him, imagining the babies and the house and the this and the job, imagining all the details of this total utter fantasy that your attachment is gone mad and is making up. Not one fraction of it is true. We do this all the time. The attachment's gone bazonkers, completely insane. Believes 1,000,000,000% in that picture, believes 1,000,000,000% that Andre is a perfect person from his head to his toenails and he's going to make me blissfully happy for eternity. That's how attachment thinks. To one degree or another. It's completely insane. We've got to have much more intelligent and more reasonable and that's why we've got to control our body and speech first and begin to harness our crazy energy, to begin to get some semblance of sanity so we can begin to listen to these crazy stories and distinguish facts from fiction. It is an enormously different job, difficult job. And we go between attachment and anger 1,000 times a day. So don't wait for the extreme examples to happen. Don't wait to be, you know, like I always quote my friend Sunny, this woman I always quote who was in Florida in prison for 17 years, accused of murder, murdering two policemen. Her husband was executed in prison. She was allowed to attend the execution, and his head went on fire. Can you imagine that suffering? I mean, talk about mad, arcane rules. She lost her children. She lost her parents. Husband was executed, burned to death practically, and after 17 years she got out of prison because she was innocent the whole time. You can't imagine. And if I can be upset because Donna said one bad word, and look at the pain of life, look at the suffering we have, small events if we compare with that, not trying to say we should be comparing. We can see. But this woman amazes me. I know now she's in Ireland. We talk, you know. My body teacher tries to support her work. She runs retreats and things for people who've been wrongly accused, who've come out of prison, you know. But she worked, the point about her, she worked on her mind. She wasn't a Buddhist, but she kind of likes the idea of karma, and she did yoga and things. And she said one day, finally, I realized I couldn't change anything. But they couldn't take my mind from me. So I decided I'm not a prisoner, I'm a monk. I'm not in a cell, I'm in a cave. So that, this isn't really the culmination, this is like we're going to get to this. That's the culmination, that's almost like bodhicitta, and that's emptiness. We'll get there. So in other words, this is the point Buddha's making. We do have anger, we do have attachment, and they exaggerate, and then we believe in them. That's the utter, utter tragedy. So that woman, if you want to think about it, have every reason on the planet to be so angry she'd kill herself. I mean, her husband burst into flames in the execution chamber. Her children, when she gave her children to her parents to take care of when they went to prison, wrongly accused of killing two policemen. And then the parents died in a car accident and the children were sent into the system. I mean, you can't imagine the pain. And there she is living in her little, you know, solitary cell for several years with a Bible. That's it. But she worked on her mind. She stopped believing her karmic appearances. She was able to, she didn't use these words, but she had the emotional intelligence to do it, you know. She was able to see that she could change her interpretation. We're now talking about emptiness, people. This is emptiness. This is the proof. So don't wait till you get all the way to emptiness. Start right now when your sister's mean to you. Yes, she was mean. But it's your anger that caused you the pain, and it's exaggerating it. Yes, she's mean. That's undenied. She was. She did those things. So the anger. But the point that Buddha's making, this is too shocking for our minds, that the cause of my suffering is not Donna. The cause of my suffering is my angry interpretation. That's it. It's almost so simple it's embarrassing, but it's the hardest thing we can do. It's the hardest thing to hear because we are addicted to the opposite beliefs. So we're already, this is implying emptiness. And we're getting to when that woman's statement that proves, because the point about emptiness, the most radical misconception, the deepest misconception, the root delusion, the root misconception that is underpinning both attachment and aversion and the other 83,997 delusions. That's the deepest lie. That believes in something intrinsic, absolute, concrete, solid there. And that's informing all of our attachment and all of our anger. Why I so believe that in my karmic appearance of ugly Donna, that's because of ignorance. Anger makes her look ugly. But ignorance, the ego grasping underpinning it, makes her look ugly out there in her bones. So all these illusions are working beautifully together, you know. And we have to unpack and unravel them, deconstruct them, listen to them, analyze them, think about it, and meditate on them. This is being a Buddhist. This is being a, you know, your own therapist, Rami, as she puts it. So the consequence of this woman, she's happy. I've met many people who have come out of prison from years, and there's something kind of emotionally stunted about them, because if they've not had methods to work on their minds, then they've all got PTSD, as we call it, post-traumatic stress, because that means post-traumatic stress, whatever we call it, is simply the inability to deal with what's arising when it arises, and we bury it. That's, everybody's got that disease. Buddha says we've all got it if you don't deal with things when they happen. So when you're dealing with them, you're sorting out the problem. So that woman came out of prison, a happy, compassionate person. When I talk to her now, she's like this little friendly little old lady. No one could ever imagine the torture she's been through for 17 years of agony in hell, you know, because she worked on her mind. She worked on her mind. She didn't drag any. She's got no PTSD at all because she worked on her mind. That's the point. Worked on her mind, you know. So she could change her mind. She wouldn't give you a talk about emptiness. It's not her thing. But effectively, that's in her mind. She's got that understanding, you know. Things that have an intrinsic nature. And it's what we call them. It's as simple as that. This is the meaning of emptiness, that nothing has an intrinsic nature, and it's what you call it. She called herself a cave. She called herself a monk. She worked on her mind, so she became happy. Right there. Right there. That's it. So simple. But how hard it is. Why? Because we're addicted, Buddha says, for countless eons of lifetimes in believing in lies, you know. So don't wait till you put on death row, okay? Just wait, just work with your sister when she's mean to you, or the next door neighbor, or the shopkeeper. Work on it then, catch your mind, you know. Check the attachment, check the anger, and realize they're lies. And then you're ready for emptiness. Now let's talk about emptiness. We'll unpack emptiness now, okay? Any questions first, though? That's been 40 minutes, okay? That's a lead up to emptiness. Now we're going to get there. Any questions so far?
There are no questions in chat, Venerable.
All right. So I'll keep going. Okay, I'll keep going then. Okay, let's look at it. Let's talk the way they talk in the emptiness literature, in the wisdom literature, you know? Okay. So we're going to look at the philosophy, all right? You know, the background, the philosophy. The essence of emptiness I'm going to describe all these things. I'm going to describe the word and everything, but the essence of these teachings, which you're already learning with attachment and anger, that they over-exaggerate. The key function of all these delusions is they exaggerate, they embellish. That's the key function. As Lama Zopa says, all these delusions decorate on top of what is there, layer upon layer upon layer of qualities that aren't there. It's very easy. So even again with the anger one, you're hurt by Donna. You're upset with Donna. You know, you describe Donna to somebody, that mean person. You know she appears mean to your mind, isn't she? You're describing a mean person. It's like, so in other words, what's happened is anger in my mind, I've got my angry glasses on. It's a very simple way to put it. And naturally, whatever I see through my angry glasses looks ugly. But we don't realize we're making her ugly. That's the point. We think she is ugly. That's the ego grasping part. That's the ignorance part. We think it's in her veins. Anger, ugliness is coursing in her veins along with her blood. She's intrinsically ugly. But anger is the one that causes her to look more mean than she is. That's it. Very simple. Attachment to the chocolate cake is so evident. Attachment over-exaggerates the deliciousness of something. So attachment over-exaggerates the deliciousness of the chocolate cake. Makes it look more delicious than it really is. We know this, but we don't join the dots, you know. So these delusions, their key functions, they embellish. They decorate. As Lama Zopa says, all our delusions decorate on top of what is there, characteristics that aren't there. That's the skill we have to learn. That's the brilliant intelligence we have to cultivate to see that. So obviously the root delusion, it's known as, is more hard to identify, but they're all working together. It's not as if when I look at Donna, ignorance is working in one second and then anger is working in another. No, anger is an expression, is informed by the ignorance. The ignorance is there totally. They all kind of merge together, you know. So what is this root delusion, this main one that all the other 83,999 delusions stem from? Well, it's called ignorance, which is a simple word, isn't it? And in Tibetan, it's mahripa, unawareness. So it's a very particular ignorance, and even getting this clear helps us to go on the right track. The very specific ignorance. But it's like double trouble ignorance. Regular ignorance is not complicated. You know, if you point this to me and say, Rabina, what's that? And I say, oh, I don't know. That's ordinary ignorance. Now, if we only had that kind of ignorance when it comes to the universe that Buddha's talking about, if we simply didn't know how things existed, we'd be enlightened in a couple of years. Because there's nothing in me resisting the truth. If you just, and I say, I simply don't know, and you tell me, well, it's a thermos, and you explain it, I go, oh, thank you very much, now I know what it is. But so this is easy to fix. This is easy. But what if I think it's a toilet? Well, it could function as a toilet, okay, but never mind. What if I believe it's a toilet? I'm convinced it's the toilet. I'm attached to it being a toilet. I'm obsessed with it being a toilet. I believe it as a toilet for a long time, and I'm super attached to that idea. You've got to rip my skin off to get me first to see, not only do I not know what it is, a cup, but I've made up a lie about what it is, and I'm addicted to the lie. So it's hard for me to learn the truth because I've got to rip out my lie first, and I don't want to because I'm addicted to it, and I believe it's a toilet, and nothing in the universe will convince me otherwise. That's the ignorance we've got. So not only do we not know how everything exists, which a simple way of putting that is just everything's dependent arising. That's conventional reality. That everything is a dependent arising. But we don't know that. We don't know that. We think everything is the exact opposite. Everything is set in stone. Everything is independent. We don't think we think that because the lie is so deep. We believe in the exact opposite of dependent arising. Therefore, the exact opposite of emptiness. So we've got to rip the lies out. We've got to even identify the lie. At least I can see the lie here and I know what a toilet is. But the lie here, we don't even know we have a lie in the mind. It's so primordial. And all of our countless lifetimes have been the cause, the result of that lie. It's so primordial. So we have to first recognize how things don't exist. Then see that's the lie and learn to stop believing in it. And that's the method to then to learn how things do exist. So I can't learn how it's a cup if I'm so obsessed with it being a toilet. I've got to first unpack that lie and stop believing in it. I can't listen to how things exist actually with having no inherent nature. There's nothing has an inherent nature, Buddha says. We go, huh? We never heard of such a dumb idea. That's truth. When you know it, it's easy. But we don't know it. We think everything is the opposite. We think everything has an intrinsic nature. We think everything is independent. We think our mind, this is the final one, our mind plays no role in anything. Everything's permanent, concrete, absolute out there. This is the lie. And we're believing it for eons, Buddha says. So you've got to first identify the lie and start to rip that away. That's the method for seeing the truth. That's why it takes us a while. Like ripping off our skin. So let's argue with that lie. So the king of logic stood prove the lie, as Tsongkhapa says, and paraphrasing it, Lama Yeshe says, the king of logics is dependent arising. That's the direct argument. That's the direct presentation of the truth that counteracts the lie that proves the truth. So, okay, just a minute. So here we describe it. We'll just talk about it in relation to the way Buddha argued with the prevailing views at the time. And he presents dependent arising at three levels, which are arguments against these three positions that existed in philosophical positions before. But they're also reflected in the way we think. We have these philosophical positions in our mind. So the first one is the argument of cause and effect. Like I said, right back with karma, that's a marvelous example of dependent arising that is a great logic to disprove ego grasping. It loosens the grip of ego grasping. And this ignorance, this maripa, this root lie. Good start. The next one is delicious. So let's look into this next one, okay? So this next one is an argument the Buddha has. This is where he, because this is where he diverged from the Hindus, you see, because he disagrees with their views. This is where, this is the argument, roughly speaking, is with the view. Okay, the first one is that everything exists, this is the correct statement. Everything exists in dependence upon causes. So we forget that one now. Now the next one, more subtle, but not the subtlest, is that everything that exists, exists in dependence upon their parts, their bits and pieces. Now we hear that. As, you know, we go, who cares? I mean, how unexciting can you get? How boring. Everything exists. Everything's got parts. I mean, who gives a damn, you know? But why he's saying that is because we don't realize it. One of the views in our mind. Is that we cling, this ego grasping, because of this ego grasping, we cling mightily. Utterly, absolutely, instinctively to the belief that in here somewhere among our parts, and we've really got body and mind when it comes down to it, and there's millions of bits of your mind or your thoughts and feelings, there's millions of bits of your body or your muscles and your ligaments and your pee-pee and your caca and your eyes and your nose, billions of bits, aren't there? There are many, many bits and pieces that make up a person. So we believe this ego grasping causes us to believe primordially, utterly, completely, instinctively, and everything we say and think and do is an expression of this lie, is that in here somewhere, as my friend Penday says, walking hand in hand with all those bits and pieces is a very special bit and piece, a very special part called I. Me. Self. Buddha says, don't be silly. Not only isn't there one, and you've got to prove it, but you don't need one, baby. We don't even need one. That's the hilarious bit. So let's do the analysis on this one, okay? Let's look at the lie. So let's do some logic now. We have to do that. That's very surprising to us. But this is the point. Even just anger and attachment, trying to prove them as liars is pretty hard. And you've got to use clarity, discipline, rigor, authenticity, sincerity, and logic because we ego does not want to give them up. And because they're lies, you have to use logic to prove how they're lies, and that's when it's a revelation. So then we're going to use logic to prove the deepest lie. Okay. Many logical arguments we can try and use. One of the arguments they say, you see it in the text, like they talk about how we have to use the logical argument called one and many. If something exists, it's either one or it's more than one. I mean, it sounds silly, but let's see if we can put meat on the bones, okay? So I'll make a statement. I have a thermos, and I have a vase of flowers over there behind me. See the vase of flowers, the roses there? I have a thermos and some flowers. Well, no, it's too difficult. It has to be a single thing. I've got nothing. I have a dorji. Here, look. I've got something. This is called a dorji, okay? Never mind what it is, but it's a dorji. I'll tell you, I've got a thermos and a dorji. Now, be analytical. Obviously, if I'm talking to you, we can all see with speech it's really helpful. If I say something and you listen to the words and you know the definition of those three words, I, thermos, dorji, and you look with your eyes, you see those shapes and colors, you know what they mean, and then you will tick the box and you will go, that's great, Rabina spoke the truth. If I tell you I have an elephant and a dog in my hand, you'll feel sorry for me. So you're relieved that I just spoke the truth to you. And now this is the point. How many phenomena did I just mention? It's pretty clear, isn't it? I mentioned I is one phenomenon. I. There's one phenomenon. Two is the cup. Thermos. Three is the dorji. That's it. So if I made a valid statement, then those three words, those three concepts, have to have a valid reference object. So there are three things. I just stated three things. That's a valid statement. Pretty straightforward. Now, what does it mean? Big deal. What does it mean is this. In this case, it's very straightforward. There is no, these are independent and separate. These three phenomena are independent and separate. That's like the simplest example of independence. Independence. Meaning, a cup in its nature to hold tea doesn't need a dorji and it doesn't need a rabina to do that job. So it's independent and it's separate. It's very straightforward. So if the cup broke, the dorji is fine to do its little job. It doesn't need a cup or it doesn't need a rabina. They're independent and they're separate. It's a completely separate three phenomena. Really straightforward, really simple. That's what, in this context, that's what independent means. And it's what separate means. There's different levels of independence. It's a very straightforward statement. Then what you would prove and you would find three distinct phenomena that you could split, that you could, you know, that don't have a relationship. Relationship is a very major word in Buddhist philosophy. There's no relationship whatsoever. That's pretty straightforward. We can prove that. So now, let's make another statement. I have a hand, a nose, and an ear. That's three nouns as well, isn't it? A pronoun and two nouns. That's three phenomena, is it not? I is one phenomenon. Look, I, one phenomenon. By the way, we are that kind of phenomenon. That's a thermos and it holds tea. You know, a flower is something else. A lamp is something else. We are an example of a type of phenomenon called I. I, person, self, me, myself, they're all synonyms. And we are one of those kind of phenomena. We're not a cup, we're not a toilet, we're not a lamp. We're an I, a person, a self. So, that statement I made, there were three nouns, weren't there? I is one person, one phenomenon. It's a pronoun, I. The second phenomenon I mentioned is an ear. The third phenomenon I mentioned is a nose. So now, these two, if it's going to be a valid statement, you've got to find three separate, independent phenomena in a straightforward way. So we can find an ear. That's easy. Look, there's the ear. Cut it off. Nose is just fine. Nose does not mind. Nose is happy. It'll keep breathing. Cut the nose off. Ear is fine. It'll keep hearing because they're separate phenomena. They are separate and independent, actually. But now we have to find the third phenomenon, don't we? We have to find a third phenomenon, which is called I, that has no relationship. This is the word that has no relationship to the nose and no relationship to the ear. We have to find that one. Now, straight away, we know that's silly. We know that. Without analysis, we know that's just plain silly. Because we know, with even just simple words, I'm me, and I, and we say, and this is the thing, now you listen to these words, this is where the trouble comes. We know without any analysis that it's just not a true statement. We know perfectly well there is a relationship between eye and nose and ear. We know that with absolute certainty, but we don't think it's true. So that's what we've got to realize, the proper relationship. We'll do that in a second. But what we believe instinctively, without analysis, we say, I have a nose. It's two things, right? Two, right there. Or especially more, when Donna insults me. Okay, let's say Donna, Rabina, you've got an ugly nose. And I will say, how dare you insult me? Why do we say that? Because we automatically do identify with our nose, don't we? We kind of vaguely know that my nose is mine, but it's part of me, but we don't give any analysis. And the Buddha says we've got to do two distinct kinds of arguments. One is we have to look for an I. Okay, the first one is I say, how dare you insult me? But she correctly will say, Rabina, I didn't insult you. I insulted the nose. That means, you see, so we, what part of us, this ignorance causes us to sort of feel in somewhere in our chest, there really does exist a separate I, the owner of the nose, the owner of the ear, the one that gets, the owner, that's the feeling we have as an owner. We say the words, I have a nose, as if you were to search, you could locate the nose.
Why?
Now, the Christian teachings say that. There's a third component called a soul. That the Hindus say that. That's where Buddha diverged from the Hindus. They do say there is this component called an intrinsic Atman, a self, without which you wouldn't exist. The Greeks call it an essence. This is exactly where his argument is. So one of the things we have to do is Buddha says, I'm sorry, people, there isn't a separate intrinsic independent I in there. We didn't think we thought that, but our behavior indicates we think it and have thought it for eons. So he says we have to learn to do this rigorous analysis, and we have to literally search. Don't just believe Buddha when he says that in these parts, among these parts in here, you won't find a separate piece called an I. He says you won't. But we can't just believe him. We believe in it so strongly, we have to do the analysis. So our job is, and this is the meditation we have to do, using rigor and clarity and precision. And one really excellent way to do it is literally like do a reverse IKEA on this package called me. Unpack the components, put all the, imagine first all the physical bits there, all the ligaments and then the nose and all the sensory and the bones and all the physical bits in one or pile after pile, put them back into their IKEA box to return, And now you're going to put all the IKEA, the bits and pieces of the mind, your anger, your love, your kindness, your subtle mind, your gross mind, all the sensory conscious. There's millions of bits of your mind and there's millions of bits of your body. So without analysis at the grossest level, we really believe when you've done all that unpacking, and they go, all that unpacking and all the unpacking, and now you're going to discover hidden in there, secret, is this little mini me who's been running the show the whole time, now been found out. No, you won't find one, Buddha says. Now, this is not the meaning of emptiness, and this is the biggest mistake we can make. This is the commonest misconception. This analysis correct is so far correct. But what we now conclude is, oh, well, there's no I, so therefore emptiness means nihilism. No. Big mistake. Big, big mistake. As His Holiness says, it's not empty because you can't find an I. That's not the real premise. It's because it's a dependent arising. And that's what we're going to get to. It's the more subtle point. And this is crucial to understand. But before we even go there, let's do more of this analysis. What does it mean? We say the words, how dare you insult me? Or when we nearly have a crash on the freeway, I nearly crashed. And the feeling, isn't it? It rises so powerfully, this feeling of an incredibly freaked out eye, the heart. Heart beating, you're having a panic attack, and the major word is I. It fills the whole of our body and mind. This I nearly died. I was insulted. Even when Donna insults me, I. It's so clear to us. We say the word with such certainty. So the Buddha says we make two mistakes. One is we really believe this one we've just described, that there is one that's separate. And we have to do the searching to prove there isn't a separate piece called I, which is the owner one. But the other one we feel is that, you know, that all of these bits and pieces are I. So we've got to do the analysis. Here the analysis is called, as Lama Zopa talks about it, the label I can't be the base. The label, we think the label I is the pieces, the bits and pieces. Well, it's all of me. This is just me, we'll say, a big lump of me and all the bits. No, if you talk about the one and many argument, this, you've got to disprove this as well. So the whole argument is the name I can't be the same as the parts. They can't be. I'll prove it with a cup. It's really easy. It's really easy. Let's say we say this is a thermos, okay? A thermos. That's a valid label for this particular phenomenon. We agree with it. And we know because it fits the definition. It holds my tea and keeps it hot. So we can all agree this is a thermos. Good enough. That's a statement, a conventional truth. So now I will say my thermos has a base. Like we said before, I have an ear. It's a true statement without analysis. It's true. But look at this. My thermos, the thermos, one noun is thermos, a second noun is base, isn't it? So we assume the whole thing is the thermos. We don't need to analyze it, we think. No, Buddha says, this is a lie. Ego grasping is over-exaggerating the status of cupness. He says it's not a cup. The label cup, the correct one to say is, this is a label. Cup is the name we give to the parts. The cup is not the parts, and parts is not the cup. Well, let's prove it. The definition of a cup, a thermos, is a flat-bottomed container that keeps my tea warm. That's the definition of a thermos. Now, what's the definition of a base? That's another noun and it's another phenomenon. A definition of a thermos base is the part at the bottom of a thermos that prevents the tea from falling out. So that's a definition of one phenomenon called a base. It's a piece of a thermos that prevents the tea from falling out. And the other definition is a thermos is a container that keeps your tea warm. The base, how can base be thermos? Not possible. They're two separate phenomena. How can thermos be base? They're not the same. So the same here with the mind, with the eye. I have a mind and a body. Without analysis, it's correct. So then we say, well, where's the eye? You know, what's the eye? Where's the owner? So this is the point with the cup. Go back to the thermos. I will separate. We're looking for the thermos, okay? We're looking for the intrinsic thermos. Think about it. Like you're looking for the intrinsic me, if you like. Pull the base away. There's a base. Now I've got a base in this left hand. But where's the thermos now? You don't have a thermos because a thermos exists in dependence upon a base. You cannot have a thermos without a base. So the same here. Our mind and body are the two parts that make up what's called I. I is the name we impute upon those two bits. It's a name. That's the final conclusion. There's no bit in there that owns the body and the mind. You don't need one. The body and the mind do beautifully working together to do the job of functioning as Rabina. You don't need an extra piece called Rabina. It's an embellishment. It's an exaggeration. This is the type of thinking we have to do. It sounds kind of intellectual, and it is intellectual. Of course, we have to squeeze our brain, but because ego grasping and all the delusions are so primordially intellectual, they're completely convinced in lies. You've got to have a lot of logic and analysis to unpack the lies until you get the revelation of the truth of it. I'll do another analysis, taking it from another direction. Again, to show the wonderful point that we just don't need a separate piece called an eye. It sounds very hilarious to us. We can't hear it properly, of course. We're so convinced when we say the words I. So here let's do an analysis to try and show we don't need an extra piece called an I, to show how the body and the mind do fine on their own. You listen to this. Okay. I forget where I say things. We didn't do this analysis before, did we, Donna? We didn't, did we? Okay, good. It must have been in Mexico. It was in Mexico. The day before, Riley. So I don't fly on airplanes now. It's so confusing to know where I am. I get lost. Okay, so let's do this analysis. It's a very interesting one, this. Okay. You know, the name of this action is Ravina's holding a cup in her right hand. That's the age. We all agree that's the valid action. It's true. But let's say I've forgotten how to do it. So you think of, talk about IKEA. You think of how you have to try and train me to do this simple action again because I've lost my memory. You know, I've got a stroke or something. I have to learn. So you'd have to list, you'd have to work out, wouldn't you, to try and train me to learn again, to know how to use my finger and this, and how to use each piece of my hand to train the thumb to do this, to train my elbow to do that, to train my shoulder to do this. There'd be an awful lot of work to do. So you'd have to do a long list for me. And this is a really good analysis. This is one example. You'd have to do a long list of every tiny part of the body that plays a role in doing the job of holding a cup in my right hand. It's really true. You'd have to do that if I don't remember it. You say to me, put your hand on, okay, what was a hand? You've got to explain to me, that's the thumb, that's the index finger, that's the middle finger, that's the ring finger. You have to do this. So there'd be a lot of instructions and a lot of pieces, and I have to have all those bits doing their job. A lot of pieces would do their job. Many, many muscles, many ligaments, many bits and pieces. It's very logical, very true. Now, let's look at the other component of Ravina that's involved in doing this job of holding a thermos in her right hand. It's obviously her mind. If this body is a dead body, don't bother. So what are all the parts of my mind that have to be trained to work hand in hand with the parts of the body to fulfill the action of holding a thermos in the right hand? Well, there's lots of the mechanics of my mind. I've got to have intention, which is I will. Then I've got to pay attention, have attention. I've absolutely got to have the state of mind called discrimination, which works second by second by second in distinguishing all the bits. I've got to have good memory. I've got to have feeling. I've got to have the eye consciousness. I've got to have ear consciousness. I've got to have, you know, I don't need taste or nose, but I need tactile, ear, and eye. There's many parts of my mind. You've got a long list there, haven't you, of all the bits of my mind involved, working hand in hand with all the bits of my body. Think about this. There's many, 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 many bits. And it's valid if I don't know how to do it. You've got to train me. Now, this is the question now. This is the point I'm getting to. You've really covered the list. You've left nothing out. Every bit knows what to do. Every piece of the body knows what to do. Every bit of the mind. Each has their own function. They're all slowly working together to fulfill the job of holding a thermos in the right hand. Now the question. What job is left over for the poor little precious little mini me in there who's feeling very left out? What job would this precious little I do that the other parts aren't doing? That's the question. So what job is left over for the I that we believe is there? What job is left over? Any thoughts, any ideas, any opinions? Any opinions? Come on. Now it's your time to talk. I've been talking for an hour and 10 minutes. Any ideas of sorry?
Nothing.
Nothing's easy. Nothing's good. But that's not what we think. It's not what we think. And I'll tell you the answer. The job that we believe the I does is it runs the show. Our words say this. So we believe we need a boss inside there. And you know what? Philosophically, that's exactly the same position of a creator. The Muslims say it, it's wonderful. The world is so brilliant, it needs an architect. But the Buddha's point is, as His Holiness puts it, we don't need a creator. Minds over beginningless time do a fine job in creating their own mess. And we can do a fine job in creating our own happiness. We don't need to be governed or policed or blamed or rewarded or punished or run. We don't need it. It's a very shocking concept, isn't it? Well, the concept philosophically of an intrinsic self is the same philosophy of an intrinsic creator. We don't need an I to run the show. We don't need the point is, don't need a separate I. That's what we're talking about here. We don't need a boss, a separate piece, an essence, a soul, a self, an Atman. We don't need, the parts do fine on their own. So the commonest thing we say is that the mind is the boss. And if you want a boss, the mind is the boss. But what we would say is, oh, the mind is the I. Well, right there, you can't have the mind be the I. We've just established, like with the base. The base is a part of the thermos. It can't be also the thermos. So the mind is a part of I. It can't be the I. Not possible. We're looking for an I that's not the body and not the mind, because that's what we feel is there. And you won't find one, Buddha says. This is not yet the meaning of emptiness. It's the first step, crucial first step. And if we leave it there, that's nihilism, and that's the worst mistake. We've fallen into the abyss of the great mistake, as Tsongkhapa says, you know. So now I think it's your time to ask me some questions, you people, about anything you like, okay? We've got more to talk about emptiness yet, but another 45 minutes, we will. Look into the use of that word. We get very confused, you know.
Well, a couple of thoughts came up on chat. One is the mind coordinating? Is the mind volition, or could the I be experiencing the action?
There's no I that isn't the mind and isn't the body. So what was the question again? Because we're just trying to establish what the I is if we think there is one. So is the person suggesting there is an I and the I is the mind? Is that what they're saying?
Well, I'm sorry. I put three different people together. Somebody.
Do not do that, Donna. Please tell me exactly the questions. I'm very sorry. Okay. Please. Oh my God, please.
When you asked for thoughts, one person suggested the mind is volition.
Okay, good. No, wait. That's not even the discussion, first of all. We're not trying to find out what the mind is, we're trying to find out what the eye is. So yeah. Is mind volition? No. Volition is exactly the same. Good, perfect example. Volition is one part of the mind, and it's a piece of the big thing called mind. So mind is not volition. Volition is intention. And that is karma. And that's the first, if you want a boss of the whole person, volition is the boss. Intention is the boss, but it's a part of the mind. It's not an I, but it's the boss for sure. Next question.
Another one said, could the I be experiencing the action?
Mind experiences the action. So we don't need a separate I to do it. The mind does that. That's covered. That's the mind's job.
Okay. Another is, does the I have the intention?
Intention is mind. That's covered. So we're looking, this is a really good point. This is the point we always answer like, we all do answer this way, but we're trying to find a thing called an I that isn't the mind and that isn't the body. That's the one we're trying to show does not exist. The boss, the mini-me, the runs, the puppeteer. I do that. I have a nose. Like there is a separate thing called an I. We feel it. We believe it. We say, I am doing it. We say, I am watching my breath. It's not wrong. But let's do an analysis. Okay, I'm saying, I am holding a cup. Yeah, but which part of you, dear? Oh, my hand. Which part of you? The thumb, the finger, the this. You break it down into its component parts. Because I is merely the name we give to all the bits. We made the mistake of embellishing the I and given it its own ontological status. Doesn't have. Doesn't exist. We just exaggerated it all this time, you know. We say, I am watching my mind. We get so tripping out when it comes to meditation. I'm watching the mind. Which bit of I? No, I'm watching my breath. We say, I'm watching the breath. You are watching your breath. But which part of you, dear? Your mind is watching the breath. Which part of your mind? Intention, attention, concentration. Give names to the bits. Break it down to its component parts. That's the discussion to do. That's the analysis we have to do. And we won't find, we will not find a bit that has that label. So everything you point to is like that. You know, you won't find a computer. You won't find an essential computer here. You won't find a central cup there. You won't find a central eye there. But it doesn't mean there's no eye. That's what we've got to carry on the thoughts after that. So any other points, Donna?
Yes, Kat says, So the I is the label given to mind and body.
Yeah, that's it, right there. That's it. That's exactly the perfect definition.
Not an I, and neither is the body.
What? What's the last bit?
But mind itself is not the I, and neither is the body.
Precisely. Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
And that's the part. And this is the part that comes. This is the conclusion that comes from this analysis. This searching among the parts. If we leave it here, then what happens is one of the earlier views about emptiness, if we leave it there that we can't find an intrinsic I, we will come to the conclusion that there is the body. And that's still not the finished conclusion yet. We haven't gone far enough. Because the views before the Prasangika Majjhimika view, which is the views that our lamas teach, the views all the views before that do posit there is something in here that does bear the label I. But the Prasangika Majjhimika says absolutely not. And one of the earlier schools of thought in Buddhism actually does say there's no independent I, but there are independent aggregates. And so we only leave it here. If you can't find an I among the aggregates, you're affirming the aggregates, and that's still not far enough. We've got more to go because there's no inherent aggregates either. So what we have a tendency to go, oh, well, I haven't got an I, but I've got a body. Oh, thank God, there is something. No. Body is a name we give upon its parts. Oh, I've got an ear. No. Ear is the label we put upon its parts. Oh, you mean I've got an earlobe? No. Earlobe is the label upon its parts. And you'll go for eternity and you'll never find an intrinsic bit. Ever. It's the same argument for everything that exists. But the point is you go, yeah, how clever this is. We'll say, oh, how smarty pants, you know, being clever here. What's the point of all this? The point of all this is when we get that, we cut suffering. That's not what's evident to us because we don't realize we suffer because we believe in an I. It's so subtle. It's so primordial. Any more questions, please?
Yes. Tom asks, is the idea of aggregates simply an aggregate of thoughts and ideas?
No. Aggregates is just this term that Buddha came up with. I mean, it's a word we know in English. I don't know what the term in... Skanda is the word in Sanskrit, but Buddha gave one of his teachings, and it was his way of presenting the component pieces of a person, and he broke up into these five pieces, five aggregates. This is the term they use, a bit abstract for us in ordinary English. It's just the five bits and pieces that make us up, and as we discussed already, we've really just got body and mind, but he adds a couple more there because they're kind of important to understand. It's just a way of dividing up something into five pieces. This is what these five aggregates are. It's just a term they often use in Buddhism when you're referring to your body and your mind, you know, just your parts, that's all. What else? Did you end on anything there?
Sandy asks, what if the I is the result of the aggregated parts as a cake only exists in the aggregate of the ingredients?
I didn't understand that. Say it again.
What if the I, excuse me, what if the I is the result of the aggregated parts?
So the I is the result of what?
Of the aggregated parts.
Aggregated parts.
As a cake only exists in the aggregate of the ingredients.
No, we either think the I is separate or we think it's oneness with. That's that position and that's wrong as well. The I is not the aggregation of the parts and the cake is not the aggregation of the parts. Cake is the name we give to the parts. The cake can't be the same as the parts. Cake is not eggs. Cake is not flour. And cake is not all of those things together. It can't be. It can't be because the cake is the name we give to the parts. Each of those parts has its own label and its own function. So it can never be. And even to bring together all the parts together can't be one thing. If it's one thing, there'd be no parts. It'd just be one unitary thing. It's an impossibility. It's the way they argue with it. Or to think about that, of course. Any other questions, people?
Yes. Mary asks, is the I, the mind that moves from lifetime to lifetime, changing constantly because of dependent arising?
Okay, very good. No, it's the right but wrong way to put it. I is the name we can give, and you want the basis of the label I, it's the body and the mind. So if you want to narrow it down, the mind is the basis of the label I. So in that sense, the I do go from life to life, based upon the continuity of the consciousness, which then takes upon itself different bodies from life to life. So I do take rebirth, but the I here is the name we give to the mind. And you'd also say, yeah, the mind and the subtle body as well. You could say like that. So I does go from life to life, but the piece of I that goes from life to life, which is the basis of the label I here, is the mind. This bad bag of bones just turns into dust. That's the way to say it. Anybody else, Donna? Anybody hands up? Anybody want to ask me a question?
Nobody hands up.
Are there any?
So far? But yeah, questions. Okay, sounds like something.
I have a question.
Who is I?
This I is Shade.
Oh, Shade. Okay, hi, baby. Talk to me.
Thank you for everything. I wonder about the moment of death. Because I imagine this is the one of the strongest moments of realizing that is not going to be there any longer, or is not. So the question hasn't formally formulated because I've been listening to the other answers, but could you speak something about death and I and the practices to do during life to, like, what is the purpose of this unraveling this identification with the I, purely to not suffer in the moment of death, or I'm just trying to understand it in the context of dying.
Okay, dying is a very particular way of talking about. One of the things about dying is that because we've got we suffer mostly at death, lovers overseas, because of attachment, and mainly because we're attached. We think I is this body, right? That's how we think, isn't it? Well, I mean, we can say these words, we have a mind, but it's pretty abstract to us because we can't taste or touch or smell the mind if we use the Buddha's analysis. As far as we're concerned, we're just this me's and this body, this bag of bones, right? So the time of death is intentionally suffering. As you start the death process, which starts a couple of hours before you stop breathing generally, incredibly intense extra fear kicks in simply because of massive, massive attachment to this, and therefore terrified of not being me, terrified of losing me. That's the reason we suffer at death. That's why there's so much fear. So according to the Vajrayana model, there are these very specific approaches that they describe, and I mentioned it briefly already. If we look into ourselves, we can describe gross consciousness, subtle consciousness, and very subtle consciousness. Each level of consciousness inextricably linked to a certain level of physicality. So the death process is described in these 8 stages of gradual deconstruction of these various components. So one of the best meditations to learn from the Vajrayana is to know that process, to understand that process, and meditate upon it. Imagine you're going through this deconstruction. First, you lose your sense, your ear consciousness, your eye consciousness, your body goes, and you imagine going through this process. And the greatest yogis, of course, who've practiced this all their life based on single-pointed concentration, as Lama Zopa says, death is what they've been waiting for. Because as the mind gets from the gross to the subtle to the very subtle, that we want the very subtle. The bottom line of all meditation and all practice is to access the very subtle level of our cognition, which is completely unencumbered by all the other junk, and that's the most potent, most powerful, most capable level of our mind. Because it's unencumbered, it's able to realize emptiness and even at the time of death get enlightened. So we want to practice, that's the best. So it's a powerful process to go through and to become familiar with. So anyway, simple level, it cuts the fear because you're ready for it and you've practiced all your life realizing impermanence. But if you're a great meditator, it's the most marvelous opportunity to grab the mind at that subtle level and then get enlightened.
So this would be a specific practice, Vajrayana practice of meditation on death?
Exactly, yeah, that's right. But and you combine it with deity yoga. You combine it with doing your visualizations of your deity. It's a way to utilize deity yoga and combine with this as a method for becoming the Buddha.
Mm.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, darling.
Thank you.
That was useful?
Yes, I need to find the resources to practice this.
Well, darling, you've got to practice junior school first. Living now, control your body and speech. Don't kill, don't lie, don't jump on somebody else's boyfriend. Control your body, control your speech, do masses of practice, do purification, go to high school, get shamatha, understand the mind, study it deeply, be your own therapist, deconstruct your delusions, go to the bodhisattva path, practice love, compassion, bodhicitta. Then you can start to realize emptiness, and then you can do Vajrayana, okay?
So,
one step at a time, baby. All the map is there. All the map is there. You can speed along it according to your capacity, but you can't miss out any pieces, honey child.
This makes me think of another question, which is that if death can happen any moment, what is the? It's okay to not work on that yet.
What? Sorry, what?
If death can happen in any moment, and it's okay to not work on this this practice of preparing.
I mean, you're only working on what you're capable of. That's why you've got to study all of it. I mean, if you're in the middle of wanting to become like Bach and you only get to grade 2 and you die, what can you do? But at least you're starting. But you can carry on in life if you're a Buddhist. You don't lose your mind. So you've got to start now. The point. But, read Lama Yeshe's books. Lama Yeshe's Introduction to Tantra and Lama Yeshe's Bliss of Inner Fire. They describe all these things very clearly.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Zach has his hand up.
Yes, Zach. Talk to me, honey.
Hey. So I have a question about this logic that we've been talking about, and specifically, like, in the Madhyamaka view. When we talk about, for the instance, like, let's talk about the cup or the thermos, and you say that the thermos exists on reliance of its parts, independence of its parts, then does that label of a thermos, are we saying that just does not exist?
Yeah, yes. What we're saying is, what this view is saying, the label Zach, we think instinctively there's a little Zach in there running the show. You get my point here? We all think there's a little I there, mini me, and we call it Rabina or Fred or Zach or whatever. But what Buddha is saying is Zach is merely the name given to the bits and pieces that make up Zach.
Right. And then
you can't point out a separate piece called Zach, which is what ego grasping desperately wants to do. That's why in all the Buddhist positions up to the Majjhimika Prasangika do say you have to have something that can be called the I. And the Prasangika say, no, you don't need it.
And then what is the distinction that the Majjhimika makes?
That's the distinction. That's exactly the one. The final view of the Prasangika Madhyamika, every other view from the Hinayana to the Chittamatra up to the Savatantrika Madhyamika, all the way, these different views in Buddhist tenets, all assert that there has to be something that is intrinsic, that is the referent object of the name Zach. The Prasangika Madhyamika said, no, there is nothing. As Lama Zopa puts it, when you realize the emptiness of the intrinsic Zach, it's as if there is no Zach, because there's not one atom of anything there that you can point to that is Zach. He says, it's when you realize that, it's as if there is no Zach. That's ultimate reality. But conventionally, there is a Zach. But what does exist is so subtle, it's as if there's no Zach. So the other way to put it is the word emptiness of intrinsic existence is the name given to ultimate reality of Zach. And the conventional dependent arising, the subtlest level, is that Zach is merely labeled.
So there is a Zach that exists, but we exaggerate its existence.
That's exactly right. So right now we have the two truths. We have the two extreme views. So when we hear there is no Zach, because we haven't gone far enough in our analysis, we fall into the abyss of great mistake and go, oh, well, there's no Zach. That's the end of that. Nothing. Nihilistic. And that's even the way we mostly speak it. We say, oh, well, it's all empty, so it doesn't matter anyway. This is the wrong conception. We completely extreme view. The other extreme view is the view of eternalism. There is a Zach that does exist from its own side, permanent. And we have to, and these are the extreme views. So the middle way, final Prasangika Madhyamika, is in between the two truths. That there is not a fraction of Zach there, but nevertheless, conventionally, there is a Zach, but that's the merely labeled Zach. So we've got to get these two together, and that's the real middle way.
That makes sense. Yeah, that clears it up. Thank you.
Okay, good, Zach. All right. Who else?
Frances has her hands up.
Yes, Frances.
Is that me?
Frances. No, you can go next, Fernando. Frances first. Where are you, darling? You've disappeared. There she is. Unmute yourself, Frances. Unmute. Can you unmute Frances, Donna?
Okay.
Speak to me, darling.
Okay, what I want to speak to about is in terms of junior school and high school, as you refer to, and university.
Yes.
I feel like I'm finally almost getting there in junior school.
I understand.
And when you were talking today about I and, you know, sort of breaking it down into parts, I thought, my God, this is a quantum leap.
That's right.
And I just wanted to say, I've read a bit about it, and is the not I leading towards emptiness? And I might even just leave it for a few weeks. Whoa, quantum leap.
Of course it is. It's wonderful. Never mind. Just listen to it. Let it go in and just kind of let it sink in and kind of taste the flavor of it as you go along. Don't force it. It's perfect.
Okay.
We're going to keep hearing it. It's perfect.
Oh, yeah, no. This is I've heard it before, and yes. I just used to, oh, no, that's not for me. Today I've heard it, I think, and I know, where it's leading.
Wonderful. I'm very happy. So keep moving, baby. Perfect, Francis. So listen, we've got a bit more to say before we finish. I've got to say something. I really want to now go, let's look at another whole sort of full stop, turn the page, new chapter. Now let's look at the use of these words and try and get our head around how this phenomenon called the emptiness of something, how it exists, because we get very confused in the use of the word emptiness. We fall into this abyss of nihilism very easily. We don't know how to use the word. Can you turn off the, can you mute, please, darling?
I'll mute myself.
Okay, darling. Okay. Okay, so let's look at this word, okay? So, okay, I've got to go back a bit. When you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn what exists and what doesn't. And this is a major point, the terms for it, the synonyms. There are about 5 or 6, I think, synonyms for that which exists. And this is hugely important to understand because the Buddha is telling us that right now we're cognizing phenomena that don't exist, and our entire job is to make distinction between what exists and what doesn't. This is the job of being a Buddhist. Finally, when we're enlightened, we're now in sync with reality, right? So, phenomenon, object of knowledge, existent, established base. Object, maybe 5 synonyms. All those words are used to refer to whatever exists. And this is meaning now conventional reality. So we can see in the universe there are trillions upon trillions of conventional phenomena. I mean, every day we're creating new ones. I mean, you just think of, since, I always think of this since Steve Jobs, the world has probably tripled in just phenomena with just apps alone and new ideas and concepts. Every day with our brilliant intellectual minds, we are creating new phenomena, aren't we, that did not exist before. And we can do that. We can see that. And they all come from the mind, of course. We're so genius. So the two truths, the perfect way, the best way, then Tsongkhapa really praises Buddha for his teachings on dependent arising as the king of logic, as I said, to prove this emptiness, which is the ultimate way that things exist. So we start with the way that things do exist, which is the conventional reality. So the shorthand there is, as we're discussing, is dependent arising. Everything in the universe, whatever we can posit as existing. But before we even do that, it's really important. Sorry, I'm blocking my nose. Before we have to establish what exists, so we can begin to describe it. And half our problem is we don't even have good communication with words. You know, so before we begin to discuss something, we've got to define it. So we want to discuss what a thermos is. We've got to be on the same page. If Donna thinks it's one thing and I think it's another, we're going to have arguments. So we've got to establish something as existing. And that's a term for that which exists, an established base. So we both agree the label for this is called thermos, the company, we know that. And we define it, a flat-bottomed container that keeps your tea warm. So the first part of that, most definitions have 2 bits. The first bit tells you its conventional characteristics was this flat-bottomed metal container. Okay, I will see that. That's pretty clear. I can see it. But I don't know what the phenomenon is yet. And this is a major, major part in understanding reality. The second part of the definition is vital. I've got to know what its function is. This is a huge thing when it comes to realizing emptiness. What's its job? What does it do? Almost function means what's its meaning. What's the meaning of that? Well, it keeps your tea warm. That's its function. So that's the second part of the definition, and that's a major piece. So now once we've signed off on that, and we've got to do even a bit more. You shouldn't just believe me. We should prove that to be true because we're establishing things that exist, not just coming from on high. This is the major difference in Buddhism. We're not just believing what God tells us. There's no concept like that. We have to prove what exists. Then we can discuss how it exists ultimately. That's the first step. It's hugely important. So we've got a conventional phenomenon. And then what Buddha is saying is because of ego grasping, that imposes on every tiny phenomenon in the universe, conventional phenomenon we cognize, it layers on top of it, as Lama Zopa said, this characteristic of intrinsic independent character. We as ignorance causes that thermos to appear back to us as an intrinsic, as an independent thermos. And independence, the broadest word, and what it means is independent of causes, independent of parts, but finally the real one is that the ego grasping causes that thermos to appear back to us as being independent of my mind, calling it a thermos. That's the final meaning of emptiness, the subtlest meaning of dependent arising. So the word function is so important. The word independent or dependent or relationship, these are hugely important to learn, you know? So now, Buddha's saying, shorthand, there is a cup that does exist interdependently that does function to hold tea. Then he says, but ultimately, finally, from the side of this cup that holds my tea, and it does hold it, there is not one atom of anything here that makes it that. Finally, as we're saying, there's nothing from the side of the thermos that makes it a thermos, because, but it does function. These are the two we have to put together. And so what it is, it's merely labeled thermos. It's a merely labeled thermos. So now, this final part saying there's not one atom here from its own side that makes it a thermos. What that means is on the, it lacks an independent nature. It lacks completely intrinsic characteristic. So the word referring to that absence of intrinsic characteristic, that absence of independent character, that absence is the word, as we know, emptiness. Now let's look at the use of that word, because we really don't understand it. We get very confused. Okay, it's an ordinary word we use in daily life. It's really a common concept that we use, and I'll use simple examples, and I'm sure we've talked before, I've said this, you've heard this many times. So, if I'm drinking my tea, and I pick up my cup to have a cup of tea, and I suddenly go, oh my God, my cup's empty. We all say that, and we know perfectly well what it means is that the cup lacks tea. It's empty of tea. We you know, it's just very simple. We say my cup is empty. It's shorthand for my cup lacks tea. My cup is empty of tea. We speak like this very comfortably. If you think the party is in that room over there and you open the door, and you, oh my God, the cup, the room's empty. We just mean it's empty of people. So we really get this concept. Now the point about this is extremely interesting. The only person, and this is a major point to get with emptiness of intrinsic I, the only person who would notice there is no tea in this cup, this is the point now, is the person who expects it. If you go to the crockery shop, I always forget what we call it in America. In English, in Australia, we call it crockery. All your cups and saucers. What do we call that? Flatware or something. No, it's spoons and forks. But if you go to the shop where they sell cups and saucers, no one will ever say, oh, mummy, the cups are empty. Because you don't walk into the shop expecting tea to be in the cups, do you? So the only person who says, oh, my God, my cup's empty, is the person who expects tea. If you look in your bank account, oh, my God, my bank account's empty, because you expect dollars. This is a really interesting point. It's a really powerful point, and we get it. So I said, now let's look at the word empty. Make it, turn it into a noun. Turn empty of tea into a noun. There's an interesting point here. See, the way mind functions is very interesting. The mind, they refer to the mind as like the subject. And it always cognizes an object. Always there's an object that appears to the mind, whatever part of our mind is, whether it's sensory, mental, or whatever. Every part of our mind has its own specific phenomenon that it cognizes, or object that it cognizes. So you could say, but then quite accurately, the mind functions like this. When I look with my eyes in here, into my cup, or my thermos, and then I'm expecting tea, and then I'm shocked. So the object that appears to my mind is called the absence of tea. We don't say it like that. We say my tea's empty, my cup's empty. But what the mind's cognizing is a very real phenomenon. It's a real phenomenon that my mind just saw, and it's called absence of tea. Well, absence, emptiness, same meaning, not a fraction of difference. The emptiness of tea. So if there were tea in my cup, which is normal, you'd say there's the mind is cognizing the phenomenon called tea in my cup. Now, if there's no tea there, you would say it this way: my mind is cognizing the phenomenon of emptiness of tea in my cup. This is a way to say it. It's a very accurate way to say it. And this will help us get to the point of the absence of inherent I. So, emptiness of something is always something that only the person who thought it would be there would notice. This is a really important point to get. Let's say you were told you've got cancer and you've got your beloved husband, your five children, your house, your mortgage, your grandparents, your family, your extended community, and you're completely in love with your life and life is blissful. You're at the peak of happiness and suddenly you're told you've got cancer. Of course it is beyond devastating, right? Absolutely shocking to you. So you're coming to terms with this unbearable truth and you're trying to give up the attachment, give up the fears, give up the dramas and the pain and the hurt, coming to terms with this reality that you're going to die. And you go to the doctor, you turn up at Robbie's office and he says, I'm sorry, made a mistake, Robbie. We made a mistake, Robina. You don't have cancer after all. Now, the phenomenon, believe me, that you would cognize then is definitely called the absence of cancer. And you'd be completely blissed out, would you not? In other words, the thing that you believed was there, the thing that completely governed your life, the fears, the misery, the horror, the depression, the thing that was causing all that misery, didn't exist and has not existed. So it's a shocking revelation, but you're completely blissed out. You now have cognized the absence of cancer. That's a very real phenomenon for you, isn't it? It's a very real, like if you think you've lost something, you're looking for something. It's very simple. It's like the tea in the cup. You're looking for something. You put your hand in the pocket for $5 or $10 or $20 for the homeless person. You know that you want to give $20 to the homeless person and you know it's in your pocket and you pop your hand in your pocket and you go, oh, what did you just find? You just found right then the phenomenon called the absence of $20. So it's a very real experience. We get this. So emptiness of an inherent I is exactly the same kind of phenomenon. In other words, since beginningless time, this ego grasping has believed in the presence of a real, independent, vivid, absolute, certain, concrete, permanent, definite I since beginningless time. And then on one day after countless lifetimes of practice, or short if you're much better, you've got your concentration, you're meditating on emptiness, and one day, one second, the penny will drop and you will see for the first time the absence, the absolute certainty of the absence, the emptiness of that I you've believed in since beginningless time. And you know now with certainty it has never existed, doesn't exist, and could never exist. That's when you have a non-conceptual direct insight into emptiness. And from that second, you climb out of your samsara and you begin to climb towards your nirvana. You've got way more work to do, honey, but that's this paradigm shift that has to happen. And that's what we've never done in our past lives. We've been wheel turning kings, we've been yogis. We could even have had bodhicitta people. You can even lose bodhicitta. But we've never realized emptiness. We've continued to believe in the intrinsic I. So as Lama Zopa says, the greatest yogis have unbelievable fear when they realize that. But the best yogis have bliss, utter joy, when they've finally seen the truth that there never has been, isn't, and could never be that kind of I. Now, there could be tea, there could be cancer, there could be money. They're just simple examples, but this is the most radical negation that the one we believed in could never exist. And we have to see the absence of that one. So it's a very vivid thing that does exist. The emptiness of an intrinsic I isn't merely, there's no I, chuck the baby out of the bathwater and die, nihilism. No, it's way more subtle than that. So now, a good example to show, let me do fine, think with that one. So do you have any questions about that? We've got 10 minutes to go. Any questions, Dean?
Fernando's hand is still up.
Yes, Judy Pye, talk to me.
I have a doubt in relation to the mind. Is the mind singular? And I'm asking this due to the fact that in his last life, the Karmapa was one, and now there are two. So,
the bodies, even the lowest level bodhisattva, Fernando, even the lowest level bodhisattva, and there are 10 stages of the path to Buddhahood, the lowest level of bodhisattva can manifest their one mind into 100 different bodies simultaneously. And by the time you become a Buddha, you can manifest your mind in trillions of bodies and trillions of things throughout universes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, that's good. Okay, what else, people? Any questions?
In chat, Kim asks, since we have this massive insistence on the inherent I, what function does this insistence serve for us?
Suffering. Very easy. Suffering. All the suffering of all the realms of existence, all the misery, all the distraction, all the distress, all the dissatisfaction, all the anger, all the jealousy, all the pride, all the arrogance, all the low self-esteem, all the dying and being born in countless realms of existence. That's the cause of that.
But we wouldn't want that, right? Why do we insist on seeing an inherent I?
Habit, darling, just habit.
An ego grasping?
It's just habit, darling. Habit. Okay. That's a simple answer. Why? You know, it's just habit.
Okay.
I mean, even just forget about ego grasping. We look at attachment and anger and all the other rubbish. And that's the real point that makes it kind of interesting. It's simply in other words, listen, why are you so good at playing piano? Why are you insistent in being good at piano? Because you practiced it. So why are we insistent in believing in an ego? Because we practiced it. Why do we insist on this or anything? It's because we practiced it. So whatever your habits are is the proof of your practice. That's it, good or bad. You see my point, Kim?
Yeah.
You see my point?
Yes, so
that's why it's hard to move it. It's because it's habit. That's why it's all a simple answer. You know yourself. If you're really good at piano, it's automatic. You can't not play piano, can you? It's so automatic. You couldn't play the wrong note if you tried, could you? You see my point? Because you practiced to perfection. That's the point. That's the point, Kim.
Yeah.
You practiced. That's the point.
Okay.
Unpractice delusions and practice virtues.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
That's hard work.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yes.
Yes. I know, I'm a bit stupid.
Thank you.
Good. What else, folks?
Okay, Allie has a bit of a long question.
Go on, let's read it out.
So this is not my mind, air quotes. The mind is the mental continuum that came together with my body due to karma. And this mental continuum will go on. The subtle level of habits and preferences. But it's not me. And it doesn't have meanness going to the next life.
That's right, exactly. But nevertheless, it is still a you, but it's an interdependent you. So you do go from life to life. But the you that goes from life to life is a dependent arising you. The mind goes from life to life. It's a dependent arising mind. I is the name given to the mind. Everything that exists, you know, the mind does continue, but you can still say I is the label because the mind is the base of the label I. Even the subtle mind from this life to the next is still a mind that does exist. There's always an I based upon that label. But it's still I, but you can't find an intrinsic I. That's the difference. That's the point. Distinguish between an intrinsic I and a dependent arising I. They're not the same. Heart Sutra, I want to finish with the Heart Sutra. It tells us very nicely about, this is where the two truths come together. And by understanding emptiness within the framework of the two truths is Tsongkhapa's brilliant method for ensuring that we don't fall into the abyss of the great mistake. Okay. So the Heart Sutra is Buddha channeling his thoughts. He's in meditation and he's channeling his thoughts into his disciples. So Shariputra and, 10th level Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara are there having a conversation, but they're really speaking Buddha's thoughts. And he gave many of his teachings apparently. He was in meditation, blissing out. So they're having a chat. And basically what the Buddha's teaching, this Buddha's teaching, is he just goes through the list of all the phenomena that exist in the universe, according to the Buddhist way of seeing the world, all the different categories of phenomena. So he talks about the five aggregates, the four noble truths, the 12 links, et cetera, all these things. So basically what they're saying is, as we know, the first of these five aggregates that Buddha talks about is the one called form, which is the very first of the categories that he describes about all being empty as he goes through. So form is the first, and that's the body. So he says, form is empty. Emptiness is form. Form is nothing other than emptiness, and emptiness is nothing other than form. Well, technically that's not correct, but what it means is this. wherever you find form, give an example of any phenomenon, could be anything at all, wherever you find form, you will find right on that form the emptiness of intrinsic form, right there. In other words, everything that does exist conventionally has a very specific characteristic called emptiness of inherent existence. So in other words, emptiness of inherent existence isn't just some abstract idea in the sky. Use a simple example. This thermos is black. You could validly say wherever, so thermos is black and black is thermos. Thermos is nothing other than black and black is nothing other than thermos. That's a really simple statement that you've got a thermos which has the characteristic of being black. And in this case, wherever you find black, you will find thermos. And wherever you find thermos, you will find black. It's meaning exactly that. So wherever, we can say this one, wherever there is I, any phenomenon, I, form, peanut, toilet, caca, any phenomenon, doesn't matter, it's the same thing. So wherever there is a phenomenon called I, the I is emptiness, emptiness is I is nothing other than emptiness, and emptiness is nothing other than I. What it's, all it's saying is this, because the two truths come together. You cannot have them separate. So wherever there is Rabina, you will find right there on Rabina the existence of the emptiness of intrinsic Rabina. So wherever you find Rabina, there is emptiness of intrinsic Rabina. And wherever you find emptiness of intrinsic Rabina, you will find conventional Rabina. So Rabina is emptiness, emptiness is Rabina, Rabina is nothing other than emptiness, emptiness is nothing other than Rabina. It's a way of guaranteeing you'll never fall into the abyss of the great mistake. It's the one of dependent arising and emptiness coming together. Very helpful. So we've got to squeeze our brains, as Lamiyeshi says. We've squeezed our brains for eons believing in nonsense, so we've got to do the equal amount of squeezing to unpack the rubbish and stop believing in it. What else? 5 more minutes to go.
Oh, Zach has his hand up again.
Okay, Zach, go for it, baby.
I just want to clarify that line in the Heart Sutra that I got some sort of understanding of it, but I don't know if it's correct or not. So when it's saying that the form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is that a teaching that he gave in order to ensure that we didn't think that emptiness itself was another independent phenomenon?
You would say that definitely, yes. There's some unique, special, abstract kind of thing, or that we think it's nothingness. Both of those, yes, exactly. Because and it says later on in the Heart Sutra that, you know, the wisdom. What does it say? Wisdom is so wisdom is empty also, but so is the realization of empty of wisdom, and even so is non-wisdom. And what that means is the emptiness of wisdom. So what he's saying is wisdom is empty. The realization in the mind that realizes that wisdom is empty, and even the emptiness of the realization of wisdom is empty as well. To make sure that we don't think emptiness is some abstract thing. Even that too is empty of intrinsic existence. Absolutely. That's right.
Exactly. Okay.
It's both to get us not to be nihilistic and to make emptiness some unique special thing that's separate. That's right. Exactly.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Rebecca has a question.
Yes, sweetie.
Thank you so much for the teaching tonight, Venerable. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So is that basically saying just that the emptiness is a characteristic of the form?
Exactly. That's exactly right, Rebecca. In just the same way, form is black is thermos, thermos is black, black is nothing other than thermos. It's black is a characteristic of a thermos, and you won't find black separate from it. So emptiness of intrinsic form is a characteristic of conventional form. You can't find them separate. That's right. Emptiness, in other words, is not some abstract thing out. We go, everything's empty, like it's some kind of abstract thing in the sky. No, emptiness of intrinsic existence, you've got to find the object that possesses that characteristic, which is guaranteed you can never have the back. You've got to have the two truths together.
So then the emptiness itself is also empty. It's dependent on an object.
No, no, that's not the way. No, 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 that's the wrong kind of, it is that, but it's not the dependent, it's not the meaning. Emptiness itself is a dependent arising. It too is merely labeled. That's the final one. Everything is dependent on other things, and that's not the dependence here. Emptiness of intrinsic character, emptiness of intrinsic Rebecca is a phenomenon that itself is also empty of intrinsic existence. Because it's also, in other words, emptiness, Rebecca is merely labeled. Emptiness of intrinsic Rebecca is also merely labeled. That's the dependence you're talking about, merely labeled. Everything is merely labeled. Everything is merely labeled. Everything is merely labeled, including emptiness.
Thank
That's
you.
That's also point, Zach's point. That's why the Buddha's in making sure we don't see it as some absolute entity in itself, you know. In other words, as he says, wisdom is empty, and the realization of wisdom is empty, and even the emptiness of the realization is empty, just to make sure. In other words, whatever exists, whatever we can posit as existing, is necessarily merely labeled. So emptiness exists, so therefore it's merely labeled. It's very simple. There's nothing outside that. Nothing outside the two truths. It covers everything. Okay. Time to go home. So thank you, everybody. We can sing our little prayer. Donna, you got it for them. So we'll do the two little ones. They have great meaning. I always think of the prayers at the beginning and the end as like two bookends, okay? We put our bookend in the beginning, which is motivating. We're going to do this action to listen so we can become Buddha so we can help others. Now we're going to dedicate all that. Every second we've been sitting here together for 2 hours, as many moments as there have been, is as many seeds each one of us has sown. So all these delicious seeds for 2 hours we've sown, how marvelous. We're going to nourish those seeds from this second forward with our practice, with our efforts, you know, keeping moving so that when they eventually ripen as our Buddhahood, of course, it's all for sentient beings, no question. And the second one, this marvelous aspiration, that this amazing bodhicitta, this incredible aspiration to be of benefit to others and then to become Buddha as quickly as possible. May it never, never, never. Kewadi nyoduda lama sangye trugyurne drawa chikyan malupa deyi sala kupasho. Jangchod semcho grimpoche, ma ke panam ke ke gochig, ke pa nyampa me pa yang, gong ne gong du ba sho.